own with Tyler, but Ben had become something of a permanent fixture at the house, and John's across-the-street neighbors Lee Robinson and his wife Mona, parents of Seth and Pat, had volunteered to come up and give Jen some time off to sleep. Tyler, of course, was failing. There was no IV, no oxygen, just pouring insure and water into him through his stomach tube. The agony was no painkillers. It was a blessing, perhaps, that the few days of neglect had pushed him to the edge of a coma. But when he was conscious, John could see the agony in Tyler's eyes. Jen had stayed up through the night, and just before John left, Mona had walked up to lend a hand. John looked around again at the grounds, the patients, a few nurses lugging buckets of water up from a creek at the edge of the hospital grounds. He could only imagine what it was like inside. It was already turning into one hell of a hot day.
"I think we best head into town," Charlie said. The cop nodded. "Good luck, and tell people up there we really need help here," the cop said. "Some of the staff, the doctors and nurses, have stayed on, but a lot left, and hardly anyone has come back."
"Why are you here?" John asked, out of curiosity.
"Somebody came in yesterday and said a couple of the nursing homes in the area were hit by druggies. Well, there's a lot of that stuff inside that building. Figure they need some protection. Besides, I was a Marine. Took one at Hue, 1968. Those are my comrades in there. I don't have no family to worry about, so I guess these guys are my family."
He then thumped his left leg, and there was a hollow echo.
"Semper Fi," Washington said, and he leaned out the open window and shook the guard's hand. "Some advice," Washington then said. "Don't stand out in the middle of the road. Set up some sort of road barrier and keep to one side. Use a stalled car as protection. I could have blown you away before you even blinked."
The cop nodded.
"Yeah, guess you're right. Forgot. Tired, I guess.
Good luck, Marine."
"You too."
They backed out of the driveway, pulled out onto 70, and continued towards Asheville. A mile farther on, as they came up out of a hollow and started down the long hill that would pass the Department of Motor Vehicles, straight ahead they could see the Asheville Mall, a thick pall of smoke hanging over it.
"Get on the bypass," Charlie said. "Don't go anywhere near it."
Driving fast, John went up the ramp onto the I-240 bypass that led straight into the heart of Asheville. Once onto the bypass, he began to wonder yet again about the wisdom of coming into the city. It was like driving an obstacle course with all the stalled cars. Ahead, through the highway cut in Bowcatcher Mountain, he could see numerous fires burning in the city, plumes of smoke rising up, spreading out in the morning heat, forming a shadowy cloud. A trickle of people were walking along the side of the road, and for all the world they reminded him of an old film clip of French refugees fleeing the German advance in 1940. Some were pushing baby carriages, supermarket shopping carts, a wheelbarrow. One family pulling a small two-wheeled cart like the type hooked up to the back of a yard tractor, all piled high with belongings, children, strange things like an old painting, a treasured piece of furniture, a stack of heavy books. As he drove by, going in the opposite direction, all looked towards him as if he were an alien. More than one tried to step out to wave him down.
"Gun!"
Washington shouted. John hunkered down and hit the gas. A man was running towards them from the side of the road, waving a pistol, and lowered it.
"Damn it, Jeremiah! Drop him!" Washington shouted.
Jeremiah picked the shotgun up from off the floor, but they were already past the man. He had not fired a shot, just waved the pistol angrily.
"You keep that gun ready, boy," Washington snapped. "And if I say shoot, you shoot."
"Yes, sir."
John looked in the rearview mirror. Jeremiah's features had gone pale. He was a good kid, a ball player. Like so many on the team, he tried to act tough and macho, but down deep most of them were small-town church-going kids, who never dreamed that in less than a week they'd go from worrying about the next game, final exams, which should have started today, or convincing small-town girls to head off into the woods with them, to aiming a gun at someone and squeezing the trigger. The overpass to Charlotte Street had two cops on it, and as he weaved towards it, one of them motioned for him to take the exit ramp off and threateningly pointed what looked to be an AR-15 at him. The interstate bypass ahead was completely blocked. He was planning to exit here anyhow, but still, he had never quite expected such a threatening welcome. The ramp was cleared of vehicles, and he turned left off the ramp and onto the overpass where the cop with the AR-15 stood, weapon leveled. John rolled to a stop.
"Who the hell are you?" the cop asked.
Charlie held his hands up slowly, motioned to the door, opened it, and started to get out.
"Did I tell you you could get out?"
"Listen," Charlie replied sharply, "I'm Director of Public Safety for Black Mountain. I'll show you my ID."
The cop nodded. Charlie slowly reached into his pocket, pulled out his wallet, and opened it up. The cop stepped forward and leaned over to look at it.
"Asshole," Washington whispered from the back seat of the car, his .45 tucked up against his left side. "I'm here to see Ed Terrell, County Director of Emergency Preparedness, to find out what's going on."
The cop nodded, then looked back at the car.
"I have orders to confiscate all vehicles that are moving."
"Listen, officer, we drove up from Black Mountain. I need to see Ed right now. If you confiscate our vehicle, how the hell do we get back?"
"You walk. I've got my orders."
"Like hell. This is my car, and we're keeping it," John snapped, and the cop turned towards him.
"Get out of the car, all of you. You can walk over to the county office. You'll find Ed there. If he says you can have it back and you got that in writing, fine with me. But for now, I'm taking it. You'll find this car behind the courthouse if Terrell gives it back to you."
"How about the other way around?" Charlie replied, staying calm. "Get in, ride with us over to see Ed, and he'll take care of it."
The cop shook his head.
"I've got my orders. Guard this bridge and impound any cars. So the rest of you get out."
Charlie, exasperated, looked towards John, who shook his head wearily. Nothing worse than a corporal type, with limited intelligence, a gun, and his orders. No amount of logic in the world could ever penetrate through to him.
"You know what you sound like with your damn only following orders?"
John asked. The cop looked at him.
"A damn Nazi. We keep the car, and Charlie here goes in to see Terrell."
"You son of a bitch, get the hell out of that car, all of you, and hands over your heads."
"Let me handle this," Washington whispered.
"Get out, you first, you loudmouth bastard."
And the cop pointed the AR straight at John.
"Move carefully," Washington whispered.
"I'm not budging,"
John said sharply, loud enough for the cop to hear.
"Out, asshole."
"It's not asshole, it's Colonel,"
John replied sharply.
"Get out now."
And the cop shouldered the weapon, pointing it straight at John's head.
"But I'll do what he says," Charlie said bitterly. "Get out, John."
"Hey, everybody chill. It's okay," Washington said.
And his speech pattern had instantly changed from Marine DI to comfortable, laid-back African-American Southern.
"Come on, bro,"
Washington said, patting John on the shoulder with his left hand, even as he slipped the .45 behind his back.
"It's cool. Just do what the man says."
Washington carefully eased out of the car, putting his hands up in the air. He walked up to the cop, grinning, his gait loose and relaxed, and a second later, the officer was flat out on the ground. The second cop started to swing his AR-15 around, but the .45 that Washington had kept tucked into his belt behind his back was now leveled straight at the second cop's head.
"Move an inch, officer, and you are history."
The cop hesitated.
"No one gets hurt," Washington said coolly. "Mr. Fuller is going in to see Mr. Terrell. Everything will turn out fine, and then we drive away. We'll all just sit here, wait, and talk. Like friends. Now, son, either drop the gun or I promise you you will be dead in 5 seconds. The officer laid the AR down. Boys, take the rifles. They're pistols, too.
Washington kept the pistol leveled as Jeremiah and Phil disarmed the two cops, the one who had been knocked flat with one blow sitting up, red-faced, blood trickling down from a broken nose.
"Sorry I had to do that to you, son," Washington said, then turned to Charlie. "Mr. Fuller, I think you should walk in. If the order is out to confiscate, we'll definitely lose this car trying to drive to the county office. We'll wait here."
"I'll go along," John said.
"Oh, Colonel, sir," Washington interjected. "I think you need to stay here."
"Why?"
"More cops might come along, and I just have these two boys."
John nodded, took one of the AR-15s, and looked over at Charlie.
"I'll get back here as fast as I can," Charlie said. "Now listen, if for some chance I'm not back in—"
He looked down at his old-style wristwatch.
"Make it 2 hours. Go for home. If it looks like you might lose the car or have to fight, get the hell out and I'll walk home later. Okay?"
"Sure, Charlie."
Charlie turned and set off at a slow trot to the twin buildings of the courthouse and county office. Watching him go, John had the same thought he always did when seeing the Twin Towers of Asheville. The famous local legend, how back in 1943 the pilot of the B-17 bomber Memphis Belle, Colonel Bob Morgan, had flown his plane between the two buildings, a buzz job, with him banking at a 45-degree angle to squeeze through. Morgan was gone now several years, buried in the Veterans Cemetery in Black Mountain, and John turned to look back at the cop with a broken nose, the old Edsel, the two wide-eyed students of his. My God, yet again. It was frightful to contemplate how much had changed.
"You all right?"
John asked, trying to sound friendly, squatting down by the cop's side.
"Screw you, you asshole," he snapped. "That black son of a bitch broke my nose."
Washington looked down at him and shook his head.
"You're lucky that's all I broke," he said softly,
all sympathy now gone.
"And next time you address the gentleman, the first two words out of your mouth are, 'Colonel, sir.' And as for me, Sergeant, we'll be just fine. Boys, help him to the side of the road. Put him behind that Honda SUV."
He turned and looked at the other cop.
"Would you mind going over and sitting down there as well?"
The second cop nodded, saying nothing.
"Phil, get back into the Edsel. Turn it off. But be ready to fire it up if I give the word. Colonel, how about you and I stand sentry?"
Washington leaned against the bridge railing, John beside him, and from a distance it would look like nothing had changed. John pulled out a cigarette, lit one, and saw the second cop looking up at him.
"Want one?"
"Yes, sir."
John pulled one out, handed it down, the cop motioning to his pocket. Washington nodded, and the cop drew out a lighter.
"Damn, thank you, sir. Ran out of smokes 2 days ago."
John, still holding the pack, looked down and counted. There were 8 cigarettes left. He pulled 2 more out and handed them over.
"Hey, thanks, sir."
The universal gesture of a trade to cement the peace kicked in at that moment, and John could see the second cop relax, exhaling with pleasure, after he took a deep puff. John looked over at the cop who was gingerly touching his now-swollen nose that was still leaking blood.
"You smoke? Kiss my ass."
"Hey, now," Washington said.
"Gus, you just don't know when to shut the hell up," the second cop said. "Stupid shit, you got what you deserve for once."
Gus shot him a bitter look, saying nothing, but the gaze communicating that there would be payback time later for the comment.
"What's your name?" John asked the reasonable cop. "Bill."
"What's been happening here, Bill?"
"I guess you can see it, sir." And though still sitting on the pavement, he gestured back towards the town. "Looting? Panic? Martial law declared yesterday. They actually executed a guy last night right in the middle of Pack Place. He had killed a cop."
"Got what he deserved, then,"
Washington replied.
How the hell would you know?
Gus replied, his voice thick.
Because, you stupid shithead, I'm a cop, but unlike you, I got some sense to me. 24 years a Marine before that. You might not believe this, buddy, but I'm on your side. But frankly, in your case, shore patrol types like you I eat up for breakfast.
Some people coming, Jeremiah announced, and nodded up Charlotte Street.
I hope you guys cooperate, Washington said.
Yeah, sure, Bill replied. I got no beef with you. Besides, you guys were right.
Wait until I tell the chief about this, Gus said coldly.
Be my guest. I'm not the one who got thrashed. John saw where Jeremiah was pointing, and the sight was absolutely startling. It was like a procession, 100 or more, mostly the downtown weirdos, as Jennifer called them. Asheville across the years had developed something of a reputation as a throwback, a Haight-Ashbury East, with a bizarre street life of aging hippies and New Agers, Wiccans, and just a lot of drugged-out kids. They were, to John's view, harmless, though the more conservative element of the city and county had real difficulties dealing with them. Frankly, he sort of got a kick out of their presence. There was still within himself a touch of them from his own youth. It was indeed a procession. Some guys up front beating on drums, a couple of girls, one of them definitely cute, with long blonde hair and a 60s-looking, nearly transparent dress on, with nothing on underneath. An old guy, gray beard and hair, wearing a robe, carrying a sign that actually declared, "The end has finally come." Another sign read, "Stop globalization." Other signs, "We got what we deserved," and several, "Peace now." Jeremiah stood there grinning as the girl came up to him and did a bit of a provocative dance to the beat of the drum. As the group passed by the side of the Honda SUV, someone slowed.
"Hey, they've got some cops. Looks like they kicked the shit out of Gestapo Gus."
The procession began to grind to a halt.
"Wow, man, revolution now!"
Someone shouted, beginning to approach Washington.
"Revolution my ass," Washington said coldly.
And the protester stopped in his tracks. Bill stood up.
"George, you know me,"
he said, speaking to the bearded character carrying the "End Has Come" sign.
"Yeah, Bill. Everything's cool here. Gus fell and broke his nose. These guys are helping out, so why don't you just move along?"
The leader nodded. The beat was picked back up, and the parade moved on.
"Absolutely unreal," Washington sighed.
"Asheville," Bill replied. "You gotta love it, even now at times. I know a lot of those kids. Most of them are okay, even if a bit misguided."
The dancing blonde came up to him and kissed him on the cheek. Bill actually patted her on the butt before she danced off. He caught John's eye and grinned slightly.
"Monica and I had a little thing going a couple of months back."
"Wow, you and her?" Jeremiah asked. Bill grinned but said nothing. John pulled out two more cigarettes and gave another one over, both he and Bill lighting up.
"Poor kids," Bill sighed. "Strange, when you actually think of it. What's happened, it's what many of them have wished for years. That one guy, though, with the Stop Globalization sign, him I never liked. Talks the peace bullshit line to score with the girls, but down deep a potential killer. Real anarchist. Hell, if he could have pulled the plug, he'd have done it and laughed. Regardless of that, most of them are okay, and besides, it's a free country, isn't it?"
He chuckled sadly and shook his head.
"They don't get it now. If this is as bad as I think it is, they'll be the first to die. They don't know how to survive without a society that supports them even as they curse it or rebel against it," he sighed. "Once they run out of food, then the reality will set in. But by that point, anyone with a gun will tell them to kiss off if they come begging. And if those poor kids, if they have food, the ones with guns will take it. They're used to free clinics, homeless shelters when they need 'em, former hippie types smiling and giving them a few bucks. That's all finished. They'll die like flies, poor kids. No idea whatsoever how vicious the world can really be when it's scared and hungry. Damn, I hate to see it. Wish their idealisms were true. Gandhi and Stalin.
What?
John asked. I used to tell Monica that, when we'd get into politics. She'd always talk about how great Gandhi was. I'd tell her the only reason Gandhi survived after his first protest was that he was dealing with the Brits. If Stalin had been running India, he'd have been dead in a second, his name forgotten. John filed that one away. It was a good point. The procession disappeared around the corner, heading back towards their traditional hangout, Pack Place, in the center of town. A Black Hawk flew over yesterday, John asked. Did it land here?
Yes, right down in Pack Place, from Fort Bragg.
What did you hear?
That's when Ed finally declared martial law. We're at war, that's all I know. The guy on board, Bird Colonel, said he'll be back in a week or so, then took off.
War with who?
No one really knows. Terrorists, North Korea, Iran, China. Just that we got hit with an EMP nuke, so he said that means we're at war. How are things over in Black Mountain?
About the same. Some looting, but Charlie got that under control.
Memorial Mission Hospital. Is it running? John asked.
No, sir. Generators never kicked on. I had to help take an old lady with a heart attack up there last night. We have some old trucks that run, a few cars we use as ambulances. My God, it was a damn nightmare up there.
100 bodies or more lying in the parking lot.
And he stopped speaking, looking back towards the town where the old Battery Park Hotel, a hollowed-out shell, brick walls standing, was continuing to burn. Fires dotted the ridgelines beyond.
The doors, Bill said.
What?
You know, the doors. The song, This Is the End. Been thinking it a lot.
Here comes Charlie, Washington announced.
He was coming back up the slope, jogging, obviously a bit winded, and motioned for them to get in the car. John looked at Bill and Gus, who was still on the pavement, eyes red-rimmed, glaring. John went over to the Edsel, pulled a notebook out from under the passenger side, opened it, and scribbled a note, then signed it. He handed it to Washington, who read it, smiled, then signed as well. To Chief of Police, Asheville, N.C. The officer bearing this note, Bill Andrews, is a professional and has our highest recommendation. The incident between us was unfortunate, but solely the blame of Gus Carter, a stupid ass who should be fired before he gets himself killed. Signed, John Matheson, Colonel, retired, Professor of History, Montreat College. Sergeant Major Washington Parker, U.S. Marines, retired. Washington grinned, and then added underneath a postscript. Carter's lucky I didn't kill him. A baby could disarm him. John tore the note out of the pad, folded it, and handed it to Bill.
Hope that covers you.
What does it say? Gus asked.
None of your damn business, John snapped.
Get in the car, now!
Charlie shouted, coming up the last few dozen yards.
Colonel, Washington said, clear Bill's weapon, please, keep the ammo, and return it.
John pulled the clip, chambered out the round in the barrel, and handed it back to Bill. Gus was on his feet, looking at Washington.
I like your gun, Washington said calmly. And, frankly, you are a danger to everyone but the bad guys when you are armed.
Give it back, Gus snapped.
I'm keeping it. Go explain to your boss how you lost it.
You damn nig—
He didn't get the rest of the word out, Washington delivering a butt stroke to his stomach, knocking him back over. Bill said nothing.
Good luck, Bill,
John said, extending his hand, shaking Bill's. John reached into his pocket, pulled out the rest of his pack. Two cigarettes left. He handed the one to Bill. Again, a flash thought of the Second World War.
A GI with a pack of cigarettes was a wealthy man. To share one with another man, or even a captured or wounded enemy, a significant gesture.
"We're out of here," Charlie said, coming up to the car, gasping for air.
Phil turned the engine over, got out from behind the wheel, and John piled in.
"I'll take shotgun," Washington said, getting into the passenger seat.
Charlie nodded and climbed into the back with the two boys. John went into reverse, swung around, then drove back down the on-ramp, feeling strange driving on the wrong side of the highway, moving fast. Washington took the two pistols he now had, the .45 and the Glock, and placed the Glock by John's side. He kept the AR-15 at the ready.
"What happened back there?" Charlie asked.
"Oh, we made peace," John said. "And you?"
"Jesus Christ, it's a madhouse in the county office. Ed Terrell is dead."
"What?"
"Collapsed about 4 hours ago, dead in a couple of minutes. That really got people panicked. Ed was a good man, tough, but fair."
"Fair, like with our car?"
"I'm doing the same thing."
John looked up in the rearview mirror.
"Like with me?"
Charlie hesitated, then shook his head.
"Course not, John. As long as you help out like this, I know I can count on you when we need it."
John relaxed.
"Okay, what's happening?"
"That Black Hawk was from Fort Bragg."
"Yeah, we heard about that from one of the cops."
"Well, it's bad. Real bad. There is no communication anywhere yet. They say they had some radios stored away that were in hardened sites and we'll start getting them out, but nothing pre-positioned. Plans as well to see if any ham radio operators have old tube sets, maybe Morse code."
"Sounds like that movie Independence Day,"
Jeremiah interjected.
"You're right, and almost as desperate."
"But news, I mean news from the outside?" John asked.
"State government's moving to Bragg. Some assets there did survive. Plus it's damn secure."
"Are we at war?"
"Nobody knows for sure with who, at least at this level. Rumors that we nuked Tehran yesterday and half a dozen cities in Iran and just blew the shit out of North Korea."
"So they did it?"
Jeremiah asked.
"Like I said, rumors."
"How can we do that?"
Phil asked.
"What?"
"I mean, hit them, when we can't get anything moving here."
"It must have been an event limited to the continental United States. Our assets overseas are still intact, at least for the moment. Oh, yeah, there's a rumor the president is dead."
"What?"
John exclaimed.
"Someone said the White House got word about 15 minutes before the blast, got the president airborne on Air Force One, and the goddamn plane wasn't hardened sufficiently and went down."
"I can't believe they didn't harden Air Force One,"
Washington interjected.
"Yeah, we can't be that dumb,"
Charlie interjected, his voice bitter with irony.
"Here, right now, what is going on?" John asked.
Even as he asked, it felt strange. At any other time in the nation's history, the word that the president might be dead froze the nation in place. John could still remember the day Reagan was shot, the incredible gaffe by Alexander Haig at the press conference when he said, "I'm in charge here." That mere misstatement had nearly set off panic with some about an attempted coup. Air Force One went down? Horrible as the realization was, John felt at that moment it didn't matter to him. It was survival. Survival here, at this moment, his family, that counted. And he drove on, weaving around a stalled 18-wheeler, a truck that had been hauling junk food, potato chips, corn chips, and it was picked over like a carcass lying in the desert, hundreds of smashed-open cardboard shipping boxes littering the side of the road, bags of chips smashed and torn open lying along the side of the road. An old woman was carefully picking over the torn bags, emptying their meager contents into a plastic trash bag.
"They did get lucky with some vehicles in Asheville," Charlie said. "A scattering of cars parked in underground garages. Their big problem is water. At least we're gravity-fed.
but part of their downtown has to have the water pumped over Bowcatcher. Though down by Biltmore and on the east side of the mountain they are still getting supplied from the reservoir. They're badly screwed in that department. That's why there's so many fires. He hesitated. Therefore, Asheville is trying to organize an evacuation.
To where? Washington asked.
Well, to Black Mountain, for one. The new guy in charge, I don't even know him, he told me we're supposed to take 5,000 refugees from the city. Didn't ask, no discussion. An order, like he was now the dictator of the mountains. Almost the first words out of his mouth when I reported into him. They want to spread their people out all over the region as far west as Waynesville, north to Mars Hill, south to Flat Rock.
Why?
Because they think we have food, that's why. The water thing is just an excuse. Hell, they're right on the French Broad River. I heard they even have a tank truck that can haul 5,000 gallons at a clip. It's just an excuse. It's about the food.
Do we have as much on hand as they do?
John replied. Charlie shook his head, features angry. They got lucky with the stalled trucks on the interstates, a fair number with bulk food on board them, also the rail yard. Two trucks loaded with 100 hogs, even. They were roasting one right behind the courthouse. Dozens of rail cars packed with bulk stuff as well down in the Norfolk and Southern rail yard. Got that from the assistant police chief, a good friend. I tried to raise with this new tin-plated idiot that the county should pool all resources, and he wouldn't even talk about it, just kept ordering me to prepare to take 5,000 refugees, starting in a couple of days.
Hell, it should be us moving in with them, Washington said.
Why, then? John asked, a bit incredulous that control had so completely broken down that even on the county level there was no cooperation.
He's planning ahead, Washington said bitterly. Far ahead. Get rid of half the people and you have food enough for twice as long, and let someone else worry about the rest. And I'll bet more than one of the inside crowd, some of the political heels up in that office and that cronies, will still be eating good 6 months from now. Besides, it's like all city folk. They somehow think there's more food out in the country.
John sighed. Scale of social order, he thought. The larger the group, the more likely it was that it would fragment under stress, with a few in power looking out for themselves first. 5,000 might be convinced to share and cooperate. 100,000, self-interests, them and us, would begin to take over, especially with the breakdown in communications. That had always been the power of media in the hands of a good leader— to get individuals to feel as if the leader was speaking directly to them. Churchill in 1940, Jack Kennedy in 1962, and Reagan in the 1980s. A single voice like that now could break the paradigm. But there would be no such voice, and a few cronies of an old political machine in a county government hall might start thinking of themselves and their friends first, and the hell with the rest. John could barely imagine what it might be like at this very minute in a city of 1 million, of 5 or 10 million.
If we let them all in, it will cut in half the time we have before we run out, Charlie sighed, and I doubt if they'll help us then. So I figured it was best not to stick around and argue. I just told him, I'll take it back to the town council.
He then said it was an order. I didn't argue, I just got out. As I left, a couple of cops asked me how I got into town, and I lied, said I had walked it. Well, that's why I was running. I got a block or two, and they started to follow me.
I know this might sound stupid, it was Jeremiah, but I thought we were all in this together. We're neighbors.
He hesitated.
We're Americans.
John glanced back to the rear-view mirror, unable to speak, then focused his attention ahead. They were up to the turnoff onto Route 70. He went down the ramp, swung onto what he still felt was the correct side of the road, and floored it. The line of refugees they had passed earlier was actually larger now,
more people on foot, some on bicycles, others having already learned the old refugee trick that a bicycle can be a pack horse. Loaded down, properly balanced, it could be pushed along with a couple of 100 pounds.
"Gun," Washington announced. "Swerve left."
John swung the old Edsel across the highway. Strange, it was right in front of the DMV office. A week ago, a dozen cops would have been piling out to give him a ticket. The gunman caused for a SWAT team to jump in. The gunman was the same as before, standing in front of a car dealership, now stepping out, waving his pistol. Washington raised his AR-15, leveled it out the window. Some refugees were scattering, others just staring at the sight of the Edsel, some just oblivious.
"Don't do it," Washington hissed.
As if the man had heard Washington, or, far more likely, seen the leveled rifle, he stepped back. Washington tracked on him as they sped past, then exhaled noisily.
"Professor, I think your student just asked a question," Washington said calmly.
John, trembling from the tension, spared a quick glance back at Jeremiah, Charlie by his side.
"We're still Americans," John said softly.
An hour later, they were back into Black Mountain. There was a roadblock up on the west side of Swannanoa. The chief there had chosen a good spot, a bottleneck where ridges came down on both sides, Route 70, Swannanoa Creek Railroad track, and I-40 side by side. The roadblock had not been up when they had driven through several hours earlier. John had slowed as they approached the barrier. Charlie leaned out of the car and a couple of the cops recognized him, asked for news, and he had confirmed the rumor that had already reached them that more refugees were coming out of Asheville. John pulled back onto the interstate there, and once past the sign marking the town limits of Black Mountain, he breathed a sigh of relief, and he felt the others in the car relax as well, Washington finally lowering the AR-15. It was as if they had gone to an alien land and were now safely back home. But as they rolled into the parking area in front of the firehouse and police station, John tensed up again. A crowd had gathered, half a thousand or more, and for a few seconds he thought they were trying to storm the building for the emergency supplies. The five of them got out, and at the sight of Charlie, several came running up.
"They got two thieves in there, Charlie," someone said excitedly.
John shook his head. Hell, half of the people in this town in the last 5 days had stolen something, even himself. He had never bothered to go back to the drugstore to pay for the medication or chocolate or the $20 he still owed Hamid. Besides, there was no money anyhow.
"The bastards that raided the nursing home!"
someone else shouted, and an angry mutter went through the crowd. Charlie pushed his way through, and John followed, along with Washington. They got to the door.
"John, maybe you should wait."
"I got a stake in this. I was there. Tyler was affected."
"Okay."
He followed Charlie in. There was a crowd gathered round the door to the conference room, and John stepped through the group with Charlie. Kate looked up, visible relief in her eyes.
"You're back safe, thank God."
"What's going on here?"
"Got these two,"
Tom said. At the far end of the room, two men, mid-20s from the look of them, one as described by Ira, shaved head, distinguishing tattoo, earring. The other, almost an opposite, looking not much different from John's students, now waiting outside. Fairly well-built, hair cut short. But his eyes. John could tell this kid was something of a stoner.
"Charlie, Tom wants to shoot them,"
Kate said quietly. Charlie sat down against the edge of the table and looked at them.
"What do you got, Tom?"
"When I got the description from the nursing home, I knew where to look for him," Tom said, pointing at the serpent arm. "Busted him 3 years back on a meth charge. Regular lab, a home just up over the crest of Route 9, owned by his cousin here."
"I didn't have nothing to do with it,"
the clean-cut one cried. "Larry here, he's the one."
"Shut the fuck up, Bruce,"
Larry snapped, trying to lunge towards him, but unable to move. Both were handcuffed and bound to chairs.
"So I went up there this morning, and sure enough found these two, wasted as shit. You'll see the track marks from the morphine. John looked closely at the clean-cut kid. There was some recognition.
Professor Matheson, you know me. I took History 101 with you 4 years ago. You know me.
John looked at him carefully. He was never that good with names, but faces he did remember. Yes, Bruce had been a student, showed some promise, then just disappeared from the campus after a semester or two. Tom looked over at John.
He was a student once, several years back.
That doesn't matter now, Tom said.
I want a lawyer, a fucking lawyer, Larry shouted. I know my rights. You dumbass cop, you didn't even read me my Miranda. So you really fucked up this bust. I'm out of here once I get a lawyer.
Brutality as well.
And he turned his head to show a swollen cheek, right eye half shut.
We are under martial law now, Charlie said quietly, breaking into the argument.
Bruce looked over at Charlie, eyes wide.
What does that mean?
Charlie stood up and looked around.
Witnesses? We fetched the supervisor down from the nursing home. She's outside.
Bring her in, Charlie said. John stood up as Ira came in. She looked worse than yesterday, hair uncombed, dirty. It was obvious from the stains on her silk blouse and the smell that she had at some point snapped out of her shock and was trying to help with the patients. She looked at the two young men.
The one with the tattoo, that's definitely him.
Lying bitch, it was dark. How could you see me?
How do you know it was dark when they were robbed? Charlie asked.
Heard it from somebody, came the muttered reply.
The other one? I'm not sure. But that tattoo, I remember that.
Thanks for the identification, she nodded.
Charlie hesitated, looking around. Will you swear to this?
Sure, Charlie.
Someone find a Bible.
Kate went into her office and returned a moment later with a King James. Charlie wasn't sure of the exact line, so Kate swore her in, and Ira repeated her testimony.
You got the drugs, Tom?
Charlie asked.
In my office. Go get them.
He returned with several dozen vials of liquid morphine, containers of other drugs in pill form.
Tom, just look on the containers, Ira said.
Miller's Nursing Home, followed by a code number, should be on them. All controlled substances, when shipped, have tracking numbers and delivery ID numbers. And she repeated the coding.
The same, Tom replied.
John, would you witness to that?
John looked over with surprise at Charlie, as if being dragged in. But the memory of the suffering in the nursing home filled him. Kate swore John in. He went over, picked up a container.
It says, Miller's Nursing Home. Tom, you next, Charlie said.
Sworn in, Tom repeated his testimony as well. Finished, he stepped back around behind the two.
You men have anything to say? Charlie asked.
I want a fucking lawyer,
Larry shouted.
Do you have anything to say?
Charlie repeated.
Yeah, I sure as hell do. Give me the damn Bible, Bruce said.
Charlie reddened, looking over at Kate.
The Holy Bible, please,
she said slowly, forcefully. Larry said nothing.
I want the Holy Bible, please,
Bruce said. Charlie picked it up, walked it down the length of the table, and put it down in front of Bruce, who was then sworn in.
Tell us your story, Bruce.
For the next 5 minutes, he rambled on. He had nothing to do with it, Larry just coming in with the drugs. Who the second guy was, Bruce didn't know. He and Larry had divided the loot. John watched Bruce carefully. The man, still not much more than a boy, actually, maybe 21 or 22, was obviously terrified. And as well, John could sense Bruce was lying. All the years as a prof had sharpened his bullshit detector, as he called it. Bruce finally fell silent.
Ira, Charlie asked, how much morphine in liquid form was taken?
We keep individual vials for each patient using it, since dosage and strength vary. I think about 40 or so.
We confiscated 32, Tom interjected.
Not much of a cut between your friend here and his buddy,
Charlie said.
You mean the other guy walked off with 8 vials and Larry kept over 30?
Yeah, That must have been it. No one argues with Larry.
Or 8 vials would be one hell of a party, Tom interjected. It's a wonder they didn't kill themselves.
You bastards.
It was Ira, her voice breaking.
I got 7 patients dying of cancer. 2 are dead now, thank God, but the others are in agony, and all I have for them is what was in their daily trays and then aspirin. I hope they shoot both of you.
She fell silent, eyes burning with rage. Larry, Charlie said, motioning to the Bible.
Why bother?
Charlie nodded and then looked back at John. John, I want to keep this formal. I'm appointing you to speak on behalf of these 2 men.
What?
You heard me. My father-in-law is tied into this. John, just do me the favor.
Go get Norm Sage. He's a lawyer. He can do this better than me.
Norm's house is miles from here. I can drive it. John, I want this done now.
I want a fucking lawyer, Larry stated yet again. Yeah, go get Norm.
John looked at him, then to Bruce and over to Ira, and then out through the half-closed blinds to the crowd gathered outside. John finally nodded and stood up.
I'll say this for them. The world we knew, maybe it's finished, finished forever. Maybe not, but I doubt that. All that holds us together now are the things we believed in, the traditions of who we were, who we still want to be. Charlie, I guess you'll make the decision. Guide yourself with that thought of what this country is supposed to be, even in these dark times. I know what you are thinking. I know what our neighbors outside are thinking. But whatever your decision, know it is a foundation point for what follows. But if we make a mistake here, Charlie, then we've lost that foundation. He paused. We are no longer Americans.
He stepped back to the corner of the room. Charlie stood silent, head lowered. Bruce started to cry. Charlie finally raised his head.
I dread this, he said quietly. I never thought I would ever do something like this. But I must think of the community.
He stepped to the center of the room, behind the chair Kate was sitting in.
Larry? Bruce? He hesitated. Randall and Wilson, Tom interjected.
Larry Randall and Bruce Wilson, Charlie continued.
I sentence you to death by firing squad for the crime of looting precious medical supplies not only from this community, but from a facility where people were in desperate need of those supplies to ease their final pain. Execution to be carried out immediately.
You bastard, Larry hissed. Son, you are about to go before God. I'm giving you 10 minutes to make your peace. Someone go find a minister for them, Charlie said and walked out. John followed him as he went into his office, and Charlie did not object as John closed the door. He pulled out the last cigarette in his pocket and lit it. Charlie looked at it longingly for a few seconds, and John was ready to offer it over, but Charlie then shook his head.
Did I do the right thing, John? Frankly, I'm so damn mad at those 2 animals, especially that Larry, that I'd do it myself without hesitation. But still, did I do the right thing?
John sat down and didn't speak for a moment. He was torn as well. Again, memory of his own temptation with Liz at the pharmacy to snatch the medicine he needed for Jennifer.
John, it's like we're back 150 years, the Wild West.
I kept thinking of that movie, Oxbow Incident. Remember the hang 3 guys in that movie, but then find out they're innocent?
Yeah, same thought here. It was just on TV last week. One of Henry Fonda's best.
A week ago, Charlie sighed. Just that short a time?
They are not innocent, though, John said.
But still, a week ago we didn't kill screwed-up punks for stealing drugs. That Bruce kid, right guidance, he might have straightened out.
John shook his head. Look, Charlie, might have been's are finished. Charlie, we got 6,000, maybe 7,000 people in this town now. How much food? How much medicine? Water still works for downtown as long as the pipe to the reservoir holds, but up on the sides of the hills we're out.
Charlie, we don't keep order. In a month, people will be killing each other for a bag of chips.
John felt the heat of the cigarette burning his fingers, and he looked around, then dropped it into an empty coffee cup.
Or a pack of smokes. I'm sorry for that one, boy, but you did the right thing.
Just keep in mind what I said on their behalf back in there.
Charlie nodded.
There was a knock on the door. It was Tom and Kate. Charlie motioned them in.
Reverend Black is in there with them. Time is just about up, Tom said.
Tom, you will not do the execution, John said.
Tom looked over at him.
You are the police authority in this town. If someone must do the execution, it cannot be you or any other officer or official of this town. That terrible task has always been kept separate from the hands of those out in the field who directly enforce the law. If not, well, he thought of Stalin, of the Gestapo. It has to be someone else.
Tom nodded, and John was glad to see that in spite of his angry talk earlier, Tom was relieved. John looked over at Charlie.
Not me, John.
No, it can't be you either, Charlie. You're the emergency government, and Kate, the traditional government. No, not you.
Then who? Charlie asked.
No one spoke.
You, John, Kate said quietly.
Startled, he looked at her. He had simply been advising as a historian. He never imagined it would come back on him like this.
Damn all, I was not volunteering myself, John said. I was just trying to keep us in touch with who we once were as a country.
I'm not going out there to ask for volunteers, Charlie said. I will not let this turn into a circus with some sick bastards mobbing in to take a shot. I want you to do it. You're the historian, John. You understand it, the meaning of it. You're a respected professor in the town. Everyone knows you or knows your kin here.
Oh, Jesus, John whispered, knowing he was trapped. Reluctantly, he nodded his head.
Where?
Tom asked. John couldn't think.
The town park, Charlie said. It's the public gathering place. I don't want it here.
Fine, then, Tom replied. We take them down to the park now and do it. We load them into Jim's van. The tennis courts have a concrete practice wall. I'll go outside and announce it for 1/2 hour from now.
The mention of the tennis courts chilled John. It made him think of the Taliban and the infamous soccer stadium in Kabul. Is that what we have now, tennis courts?
Maybe in private, Kate ventured. Maybe in private. I don't like the thought of public execution.
I don't either, John said slowly. But we have to do it. There's fear in this town. I'm hearing people say that the refugees from the highway are outsiders. We're already beginning to divide ourselves off from each other. We do private executions, and I guarantee you, within a day, there'll be rumors flying from those who don't live here that we are doing Stalinist courts and executing people in the basement of the police station. If we are forced to do this, we do it in public.
Besides, Tom interjected, it's a statement to anyone else who might be thinking about stealing.
Wait a minute, Tom, John said. I pray we aren't down to killing people for stealing a piece of bread.
Tom shook his head angrily.
John, don't misread me. You might not believe this, but I don't like it any more than you.
John stared into his eyes and then finally nodded.
Okay, Tom. Sorry. I'll go make the announcement.
Tom,
Kate said,
adults only.
I don't want kids down there.
Tom left the room, and seconds later there was the crackling hiss of an old handheld megaphone, and Tom began to speak. There was a scattering of applause, even a few cheers. Someone shouting a rope would be better.
Damn, it did feel like an old western, John thought, the crowd all but crying, lynch 'em.
The crowd immediately broke up, many setting off for the park, some, especially those with children, staying behind. Long minutes passed, John silent, looking out the window. He heard cursing from out in the corridor and crying. The two were being let out.
"We better go," Charlie said, and opened the door.
John felt as if he were being led to his own execution. Could he do it?
All those years in the army, the training, but never a shot in anger or even in detached professionalism, as they were told they should act. During Desert Storm, he was XO of a battalion, but even there he was in a command vehicle a couple miles behind the main line of advance, never on the actual firing line pulling the trigger. He thought of the taunting rednecks back when he was in college, the frightful moment when rage drove him to the point that he might very well have shot one, and the shock of it afterwards, and then the shaking of hands with one of them only days later, and a shared drink. He was outside. The two were in the back of Jim Bartlett's Volkswagen van, handcuffed, feet chained. The back of the van door was slammed shut, Tom up in the front seat with a drawn pistol. Reverend Richard Black crouched down between Jim and Tom. John looked at the two as the door closed and realized when he made eye contact with Bruce, barely remembered but still a former student, there was one thing he could not do. He saw Washington with Jeremiah and Phil, and walked up to them. "Washington, I need your help. God, do I need it." And John told him. Washington nodded, saying nothing, and got into the car with John, Kate, Phil, and Jeremiah squeezing into the back seat, Charlie up front with Washington and John. The two vehicles set off, and as they turned onto Montreat Road and then the side street over to the park, he saw people walking fast, heading for the park, others just standing there, staring. "Killing is a sin!" someone shouted as he drove slowly, following the van that was dragging along at not more than 5 miles an hour. It was like a damn procession out of the French Revolution, he thought. They rolled down the steep hill to the corner of the park, a large crowd already gathered by the tennis courts and the concrete practice wall painted white, bits of paint flecking off. The two were led out of the back of the van, and all fell silent. Swallowing hard, John stopped the car. He looked over at Washington.
"Just aim straight at the chest, sir," Washington said. "You try for the head, and you're shaking it all, you'll miss. First shot to the chest, he'll collapse. They don't go flying around like in the movies. Usually they just fall over or sag down to the ground. Once he's on the ground, then empty the clip, just empty it. If you have your wits about you, put the last shot into the head. Do you understand me, sir?"
Washington handed the Glock to him.
"Around is chambered."
John nodded. He got out of the car and the crowd separated back, opening a lane, the two prisoners ahead of them. Bruce was crying, begging, Larry silent, Reverend Black holding Bruce's arm while Tom had Larry in a tight grip.
"This is wrong, Charlie!" someone shouted.
And there was an angry mutter, shouts back, arguments breaking out. The condemned were led to the wall and placed against it. More shouts from the crowd, some against, most for, a few yelling to string the guilty up rather than shoot them. Sickened, John looked around. And before he even realized what he was doing, he raised the gun straight up in the air and fired. Bruce let out a scream of terror and collapsed to his knees. There were cries from the crowd and then silence, all eyes on John.
"I have been appointed to do something I never dreamed of in my worst nightmares," John shouted.
No one spoke now.
"I will confess to you, one of these men I cannot bring myself to shoot. He was once a student of mine. I have asked Mr. Parker, a former Marine Sergeant Major, to do that task for me, and he will do it. Our world has changed,"
and John's voice trailed off. But then he raised his head.
"But this is still America. I want to believe this is still America. We are at war. Mr. Fuller will hold a town meeting this evening in the elementary school gym and share with you the latest news and information. This is a meeting for all of you, those born here, those who moved here like me, those whom circumstances now place here." He paused again. "All of you are citizens of our country. Mr. Fuller, who was director of public safety prior to this war and is thus now," he looked for the right word,
our temporary leader in Black Mountain under martial law. We'll share with you the news we have from Asheville about what has happened, is happening, will happen. We are at war, and Marshall